Mr. Hayes, Reel 12. We were talking about your time with the 5th Royal Tank Regiment at Wilster and then later on at Ham.
Yeah.
What happened when you came back from the instructor's course?
I was sent to see the colonel, and that was a laugh a minute. Because what we did, we marched into a room, and I couldn't understand why they were all sergeants there, with the exception of me. And so when the sergeant made us, I said, right, quick march, and I tagged on to the end of these sergeants. I thought, well, he didn't tell me to stay here. So I went in, and they were there to get a rollicking for giving their whiskey ration to the other ranks, which they weren't supposed to do, and some of them had got K-Lied and started to wreck the town or something. And the colonel was giving them a right rollicking. He was very strict at what's his name, was Luca. Colonel Luca. And so, all right, you know, you've been told, right, march on. So as I was marching, I was the last one out, and I said to the sergeant major, well, was I supposed to be in there? And I said, no, not really. I said, but you ordered us all in there. He said, you're right, I did order you all in there. I didn't notice you at the back. So he said, oh dear me, he said, you'll have to go in and see him again. So he went in and did all the proper things. Anyway, he congratulated me for, you know, sort of what results I'd had from the test that they'd placed. We were down there about a week, I think. And it was a very good course, though. But these other people were just absolutely out.
Now, what were your duties when you got back?
I never used them. I was just still driving the tank, but I was still getting paid as a driving mech instructor, which pleased me no end. Because, oh, honestly, it was a bit of a rag-tail army, I thought, at that particular time. Strange thing happened. We nicked one of these racing skiff things, you know, long ones. We put a man in and he had a double oar. Now, look what they did. They found it around all the canals in the middle of the night to get it back to our place. Because the canal was right outside our building. And they got it down the cellar and they painted it a different colour. And they managed to get all of one of these double-ended oars. And the sergeant, Sergeant McKibben, who was as straight-laced as they come, he was very athletic. And he used to say, anybody using that racing skiff you've got, could I borrow it instead of while you're out running or whatever you're doing? And I used to borrow it, you know. I didn't realise we'd pinched it from the other side of town. And this went on for some time. This Sergeant McKibben was the one that had the... And he always used to fascinate officers inspecting us. The Finnish Volunteer Medal, which was the red one with the two red stripes on. The black one with two red stripes on. And but then we got ordered to go down to
Ham. When would that be, roughly?
I can't remember.
Okay. So what were you doing down there?
Well, we took over a cavalry barracks. And it was because, you don't tell you these things, apparently there'd been discontent in the Ruhr. So they decided that they didn't need us up in Schleswig-Holstein, that they'd bring the division down into the Ruhr. And we were put into a German barracks there, and it was absolutely fabulous. Much better barracks than we ever saw. It had been bombed a bit, but they had a swimming pool and various things. But there was a strange thing happened there, and it was funny, I'll never forget it. We had a fellow posted to us, and his name was...
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, he'd come from the Veterinary Corps. And we said, well, what were you doing in the Veterinary Corps? So he said, well, we needed a lot of Veterinary Corps, because there was a lot of German horses running loose, and it was our turn to round them up and, you know, sort them out. So then he was posted to us, and the first time he went on parade with his great coat on, And it was quite a common thing for people to think, yep, that'll get away, just to cut the great coat short. And he said, he got behind us, whoever the officer was, what the hell are you cutting it? And he said, he said, as issued, sir. Why, where did you come from? Veteran commercial. Well, that was, you know, there was no answer to that. So they'd acquired, over the time we were there, 3 or 4 hunters, which they, you know, sort of kept for themselves. They had a bit of a barrack block, stable block in there. And this troop, whatever his name was, he was in charge of the horses. So we went on leave, and he was very friendly with one of the girls in. It wasn't a nappy, it was a nappy type of thing, but it was a German girl serving, and they called it the Kerr House. It was in a park, and it was a beautiful place. Anyway, this Willie Naylor was going out with this bit of stuff, so when he got back off his leave, we said, hey, you know, they've got a new manager in the Kerr House, a nappy fella, and I said, he's going out with your bit of stuff. So he didn't say anything. He went out, and I could see he was in a bit of a temper, so he went down, saddled one of the horses, galloped out of the main gate and down the main road, and swung into this park thing that the Kerr House was. And this is a story he told us, and we quite believe what he did. He tied his horse up, slipped off his horse, tied it up outside the Kerr House, and strolled in and spotted this officer type. They were dressed in khaki. So he went in, marched in, and saw this fellow come to, what are you doing here, you know? And really just drew his fist back and knocked him out cold. Bash! Like that. So he said, well, what happened? He said, I was under close arrest. You know, taken under close arrest. So I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I was put in the guardhouse. He said, till dinner time. So I said, what the hell? He said, they realised they got nowhere to feed the horses, so they had to let me out. I thought, well, that's typical, that. I said, you're telling, I was telling the truth. I said, you said, I'm not telling you a lie. He said, that's actually what happened. I said, never heard any more about it. We didn't get down into the town very much, because we were outside the town. But I mean, the people were not, you know, nice, unless you upset them, and some of our fellows did, I'm afraid. We had these, I don't think you've ever seen them, they used to call them bunker hotels. They were air raid shelters, really, and they were about 6 stories high, all concrete. Don't there's any windows in them. But after the war, they let them off in flats and all sorts. And I think they're virtually, although they're both down, they're virtually bomb-proof. These things, instead of crossing underground. And there's always 2 or 3 in any big town. And what do they used to call them?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't really matter. Anyway, one of our fellows, our training ground was at, oh, I can't remember.
Doesn't matter.
It was way out in the country, and it was the one where the Germans used to train, and it was on the side of a hill, and it was a fabulous place. All the barracks were in blocks, you know, down the hill, and it was where the Panzer divisions used to train. They got, I think it's 4 of us, I think, in the back of the 1500. And this sergeant came out and I said, where are we going? He said, we're going to pick up one of the regiment and he's up on a murder charge. So we're on the back of this truck. And instead of him keeping his mouth shut and said, we're taking you back to the regiment, and these 4 fellows are to guard, he said, you're up on a murder charge. I thought, well, that's a very nice thing to say. We're all sitting here with, you know, sidearms. He's away from the, what's the name, if this fellow decides he wants to jump out the back of the truck, we're in stuff. Anyway, I thought, well, it's a stupid thing for him to say. Anyway, I never got to know what the true answer of that was. But we dumped him off, and I thought, what a stupid thing to say. Then the next thing that happened then, we needed to change our tanks. We were hounding in the Comets and getting Centurions. So they were all balled up, these Comets, and we got to take them up to Hamburg by road on a transporter and dump them off in Hamburg by the Autobahn, and pick up the new ones, the Centurions, which was a much heavier tank again, and a much stranger beast than a Comet, and to bring them back. And that was a bit of a hairy job, because they'd had to, because of the extra weight, they had to strengthen all the bridges on the motorway all the way down. And I just hope they didn't miss one. So on the way down, there was a railway bridge that they knew they couldn't get under. Anyway, and we all swung off the road and went up this embankment, which was straight, you know, strengthened with railway sleepers. Sleepers across the track and down the other side. And somebody missed the turning and tried to get under the bridge. He got under the bridge and got so far under, and he decided, we can't get under this, so he decided they'd offload the tank. So what actually happened then was, as soon as they unloaded the tank went up like that, and he got well and truly wedged under this girder bridge. And as far as I know, it's still there. I don't think it would be, but we've got no ways of moving it.
What did you think of the Centurion?
They were very good, very good tank. The strangest thing about it, they had two reverse gears, which was a bit hairy, so you got used to it. Yeah. It was only, say, 1 mile an hour and 4 mile an hour, but, you know, when you put it into fourth going back, into 4 mile going backwards in one of those things, it was a bit hairy, like you're raising, really.
What were they like, the rest of them, as a tank, compared to the Comet?
They were much superior than the
Comet. In what way?
Well, they were better armoured, and they had a better gun on them all around. It was the first, what would you say, post-war tank after the ones we'd had. And they weren't based on anything else. But they were strange tanks. They had much heavier armour, and instead of being able to lift a plate, you know, an engine plate, you have to lift them in sections that wide, because it would be too heavy otherwise, and they were all strengthened, you know, all the way along, so we got the lift on with them. And we never had much to do with the engines, because I was almost getting ready for demob then, I think. And they were the ones that they sent to Korea. They actually fought in Korea.
Now, when were you demobilised? Because you must have been out there for nearly 2 years.
It was the middle of 47, I came out.
It says August.
Yeah.
Would that be right?
Yeah, it was York Race Day.
What do you remember of the demobilisation?
I was disappointed, because we were expecting to meet some of the people that I'd gone in with. You know, I thought, I'm going to meet some of these people. But no, it wasn't to be. But I ended up with doing stupid things. I wanted a greatcoat, and it was about three sizes too big for me, the only one I got. So I'm not having a Mackle. And I swapped it actually with one of the local tailors in the end for one that fitted me.
Now, had you ever thought of staying in the army at the time?
Yeah, one time. I think I would have done, but I thought I might like to go and join when I got a bit better pay, on the Canadians or the Australians. I don't know. I liked army life. But and I was quite wrapped up with it. But when I got home was entirely different.
Now, what did you do when you got back? I mean, did you go back into the family business?
Yeah. By this time, my brother, who had been running it in my absence, had bought a place of his own. But then it was entirely different, and I slid back into it. And Madam Officer, what the hell did you do that for? Because what you were doing, it was entirely different. You were grafting and grafting hard, and the only people you normally spoke to were women. And I was a talker, so I'd be where it should take them on a Saturday morning, you know, till 12 o'clock. It'd be 2 o'clock before I got home, because I had a habit of getting talking to people. Now I'm a joke along then, so I went in the Auxiliary Air Force, then was the next thing, which was.
Now, that's as a territorial, is it?
Auxiliary Air Force. But the strangest thing was, I joined, I don't know whatever it says in the.
That's not full time, is it?
No, you join for 3 years. It says a year, but you actually do 3 years. And shortly after I joined, which was into the next year, it was 1950, 51.
And which squadron did you join? It says 610.
610 squadron, which was a fighter squadron. And its base was at Hooton Park before the war, and they eventually came back. It was a lot in the Battle of Britain, the 610.
So you were with them from 1950 to 1953?
Yeah. But the second year, 51, they suddenly announced that we were all getting called up for 3 months, or, as they said, embodied. So that meant full pay, whatever length you wear, best dressed uniform, and all the taggings as if you're a regular, and you are bound by that, you know, regular, I'm saying. So I went in to see the squadron leader, and I said, I don't think I can do it. We've got to come on, Mr. Sergeant. So he said, why? I said, I've got a one-man business. So he said, you're married? And I said, yes. He said, right, your wife's got a one-man business for 3 months. And I actually kept the business going for, we were away actually for 1 month out of that 3 months. We went down to Horsham St. Faith. And the other time, I used to do the milk round and then go and do my Air Force duties. And then eventually,
And what were you doing during this call-up?
They were converted. The pilot, the flying people, were getting them. This is why they wanted us all together. They were converting from Spitfires to Comets.
Meteors,
I mean. Don't confuse with this. You know, the twin-engined jet engines.
So why did they need you in? They wanted to do pilots in the whole squadron.
They wanted the whole squadron in because there were other duties to be performed, and you know, even.
So you were issued with Meteors after that.
Yeah.
And what was your role in the squadron?
Well, I was. As soon as I got in, they looked at my paper and said, "Right, we'll put you in for a trade test," which they did. Sat as trade test and said, "Right, you're now a motor mechanic, servicing." And you'll get paid as such as an LAC. And it was.
So you weren't on the planes, you were on the.
Oh no, on the what's names? On the supply. Mainly, we supplied all the tankers for the airfield in our section. But we also had to maintain those tankers. And they were quite big tankers in there. And we'd have to, you know, sort of when the planes landed, we'd have to come down and wait for a green light before we could cross the pedal track to go in and, you know, refuel the aircraft.
Now, I want to move on now to the effects of your war service, because one thing was you got some pensions, and one of it's quite interesting. Could you tell us about your pension situations? Because the war did have an effect on you, didn't it?
Yeah, well, we had a hearing loss to start with, which I knew it was deteriorating. What actually happened, which brought it to a head, was I started to have these meniere's attacks, which was dizziness. And eventually it was diagnosed through all these electronic gizmos. And so I put in for, they sent me to see an ENT consultant. And he said, well, normally they wouldn't operate on that left ear, which was the problem. We normally wouldn't operate on that ear because it's a delicate operation, and they destroy the cochlea, which is the right inside the inner ear. And there's two ways of doing it. Either they go behind your ear or they go through your eardrum. So he said, in your case, you've got very little hearing left in that left ear. So he said, we'll go through the eardrum, which eventually they did. And it was a professor of what's his name, Davidson. He was very, very good. And he went in and destroyed the cochlea, which is your balance. You know, there's fluid in it, and it destroyed that. So then, I can't remember. At one point, they said, now, for God's sake, don't let anybody, you know, touch that right ear, whatever your problem is, because if they destroy that, you've lost all your hearing. So I said, okay. So I don't know what went on then, but Then they decided my hearing and this was going down. So they sent me for audiograms and one thing and another. And anyway, I know what happened. They sent me to, before I went to Davidson, the one that was actually did this operation, they sent me to the Ian Ogson Throat in Liverpool, which was a separate hospital at the time. And a claim for, oh, I know what it was. It came to a head over the menias. They said they couldn't have the menias on anymore. So they sent me to Liverpool on their behest of, when I put in for this menias pension. So anyway, sent me to see, and I went to see, and I felt sorry for a name, Rogers. And he said, what have you come for? So I said, well, you know what it's come for. And he said, he listened to him, tried everything. He gave me an audiogram at the same time, a very primitive one, I must say. And he said, I didn't like him for one thing, because he was getting paid by the war minister or whatever. And he was, aggressive from the time I walked in, so was I suppose. But anyway, he listened to what I had to say, and I said, oh, he said, I'll tell you one thing, that hearing loss of yours is definitely noise-induced, i.e. war service. So I said, oh, well, that's news, because everybody had turned it down before. So I said, that's news. I said, well, okay, well, that strengthens my case against menias. Oh, no, he said, oh, no, nothing to do with your menias. I said, okay. So then, the next thing is, without any more saying, they sent me a pension, a low pension, for hearing, war hearing loss. So they wrote out of it. So the next thing is, I said, they came up about the menias again, and I was told, the war pension advisory fellow, and he said, oh, I said, I'm fed up with this. He said, we'll have to go before another committee. He said, oh, no, he said, it's just administrative, this. I said, okay. No way. I was sent to Manchester. Christine came with me, and, you know, anybody that, sort of talks roughly to her dad, she gets the length of her tongue before she's finished. And while we were in there, the Legion fellow came over to see me, and he said, "Pardon me, Mr. Hayes." So I said, "What for? I want a word with you." So I said, "Why?" So Christine, interesting. So I said, I said, "No, you're not. You're not representing me." And of course, he really went to me, and he went reporting me back to the panel. Anyway, I was crafty enough to alter my story when I first went in there, because I'd crossed swords with Legion people before. And they were usually retired officers that were, although they were doing it on a voluntary, they got a retainer for the day and travelling expenses, and they were making a nice little number out of it. And it was very complicated, many of us, and I said, well, do you know, this was at the other hearing, do you know anything about me? Oh, they're very, I said, you've read the papers. I said, you're only here 5 minutes, how can you read all the papers? So anyway, I went in, and the panel said to me, I believe you won't let the Legion represent you. I said, no, no. But I didn't say what I'd said before to him. He said, why? I said, because he's only been here 5 minutes. He wouldn't have time to read me papers. And I said, I know more about it than he does. I never liked him enough. So I represent myself, taking all my papers in and everything. And strangely enough, the fellow who was sitting alongside me, who was not a war pensions, well, he was in a way, war pensions fellow. He was helping me all the way along the way. He was saying, you'd ask me a question, I have my papers, and he said, oh, you're looking for so-and-so, Mr. Hayes. It's there, in front of you. And I went through it, and I thought, oh, no way am I going to get this. Anyway.
Now, you haven't told us what the link is to when you got the menias yet. Because your thing was to prove that you'd got that it was from your war service.
Yeah. Well, what had happened was, why it was brought up again, and I've got it in the paper somewhere, that somebody put in the British Legion Journal that Menias was now going to be accepted as a war pension.
No, but you haven't said which part of your war service had caused them, Menias.
Yes, I know, but that was the problem, proving it.
No, but you haven't told us.
No, well, I never did prove it, to my satisfaction, because apparently they wrote to the regiment, and I quoted that field at Shire where we got blown up with mortars. And they said, no record of it. And I knew they hadn't got a record of it, because I didn't tell them.
That's what you think caused your menias?
I think that's what caused the menias to start with. It was that first couple of days in what's name, blown up by mortar fire, which was very, you know, very much named.
Now, you weren't able to prove that, so what happened at your case then? Why did they accept it?
Because it was what happened was, they'd reviewed all these cases, and they said, because of the probability was stronger than the non-probability, and they said, okay, and we think these cases should be accepted as for war pension. And this is what happened. And I went back in and had a discussion about it, because he said, you were turned down before. I said, yes. He said, well, what has altered? I said, nothing in my concern. Nothing at all. It's your people, your learned professors in London, that have quoted this in the British Legion thing. And he said, but we sent it to Mr. Rogers. I said, I know you did. And he was the man that first diagnosed it in Liverpool years ago. So I said, he couldn't argue against it, really. And anyway, gave him what I thought of them. Not what I thought of them, but I thought of them. Said, well, I can't alter my story. It's your people that have altered the story. You have now raised the possibility that this has been caused by war service. So I said, that's why I'm here. So then he said, fortunately, there was an ANC consultant on the panel. And he said, okay, wait outside. And we came back. And he said, we've granted your case in full.
So you now get that pension?
Yes.
Now, what are the symptoms of Meniere's disease?
Well, there's supposed to be sickness and nausea, which I didn't know. You suddenly start getting thrown off your balance, and you get swirling, and I can't remember how it does, it swirls one way or the other. And you just drop it. I haven't had many attacks since, but if I am in a shop or something, I was in a market last night, and noise gets at you as well, you know, noise, and a certain rhythm, and suddenly you're gone, and you're down on the ground, absolutely wet out, and it takes some time to come round, you know, and it's happening when I was
and is that controlled by drugs then?
It is now, and there's only one drug that's like everything, and the only one that calms it is a drug called Stematol, and it's quite a common drug for dizziness. But they tried me on all sorts. Some of them,
because it caused your early retirement, didn't it?
It did, because I couldn't drive. That was the basis of it. I couldn't drive because I went out on the road. I just went round the block like that, and every turn I got to, I turned the wrong way, and some of these were block ends and junctions. And I went back and I said, well, I can't drive. And Madeline wasn't driving at the time, unfortunately. And we had to get another retired dairyman to finish the round for me that particular day. And I always bought them every year, four transits. I only ran them a year, and it was easier to change them than pay for the pairs.
So that you retired shortly after that?
Yeah.
Because that was when you were 50, wasn't it?
Yeah, and one of the big combines brought me out, who I'd dealt with for years, and they were very understanding, and you know, and then offered me a job after that. But, I don't know.
Well, thank you very much.